Com. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. When it comes to retirement, Americans are on their own. Social Security is shaky and hardly enough. Company pension plans are a vanishing species. Today, it's all about the promise of the stock-dependent 401k. In the booming market of the 1990s, retirement funds skyrocketed, then recession hit, companies went under, stocks shrank, and millions of employees are right now watching their golden years turn gray. This hour, negotiating retirement in good times and bad. Negotiation is what it's all about today on Capitol Hill. Congress returns for the second half of the legislative year. On the front burner is the economic stimulus package. Again, this week, Senate Democrats plan to push a revised version. Earlier, I spoke with Juliet Eilprin from The Washington Post and asked what the Democrats want to keep in the stimulus package and what is on the chopping block.
They have a number of provisions that are still in there, such as benefits for unemployed workers, health insurance, health coverage for these workers who have been laid off, particularly as a result of what happened on September 11th and the worsening economy. They do include some of the tax cut provisions, but they have left out some of the more controversial elements, such as reducing the alternative minimum tax for corporations. Essentially, Tom Daschle, the Senate Majority Leader, has argued that Congress should pass what the two parties could agree on, and then later they can go back and revisit some of the more difficult provisions.
How are Republicans responding?
Well, they obviously are saying that they're open to compromise and that they're willing to look at what Daschle's doing. At the same time, they're certainly falling short of embracing this as the best way for Congress to proceed.
Juliet Eilprin, when Congress adjourned without passing a stimulus package, there were plenty of voices that said, you know what, we really don't need it. It might just be a bridge too far at this point anyway. We're better off without it. What's happened to that view?
Well, some economists and some lawmakers would say that that's the case. There's also tremendous political pressure on both sides to pass some sort of package. Daschle, for instance, has come under fire from a number of Republican critics, with people accusing him of being obstructionist, and he's very sensitive to that, and that's one of the reasons you see him pushing for some sort of legislation. Again, on the Republican side, Republicans say that they do want something to happen, and they argue that, you know, without pushing more tax cuts into law, the economy is going to be worse off. So you certainly will see an earnest effort on both sides to get something done.
And the pressure is because of the continuing layoffs primarily that we see around the country?
Yes, and I think there's just concern from politicians that if they don't do anything and things continue to get worse, they're going to be blamed in the fall elections. Mm-hmm. So both sides have something to lose from inaction.
There are other hot-button issues as Congress returns: energy, campaign finance, cloning. Take us through some of those and tick off the others you see Congress facing this session.
Sure. On energy, the Senate has not acted on the Bush energy plan, something that the House passed last year. One of the most sensitive issues there is whether to approve drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
So this is Democrats wanting more conservation versus Republicans wanting more oil production?
Exactly. And it was a dicey vote in the House, but ultimately the House did approve this drilling. And so the real question is, what happens in the Senate? And if the Senate rejects drilling, you know, how do they work out a compromise?
Campaign finance?
Campaign finance is something that's sure to resurface in the House fairly soon. What's happening is that the backers of the Senate-passed reform version championed by John McCain and Russ Feingold have started a discharge petition. It's a procedure by which they can try to force a vote on the issue by gathering the signatures of 218 lawmakers. That's a majority of the House. And they're very close. They just had another Democrat, Corinne Brown from Florida, sign on today. And now they're literally just three votes shy of the 218 votes they need. In addition, the whole controversy over Enron, which we can discuss in a minute, has also added to the pressure on Republicans to bring up campaign finance
reform. Do something, flame to that fire. Before we go there, how about human cloning? We know it's a new century when we're asking about that, but there it is.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that, again, it passed the House by a sizable margin, and it's something that will likely come up at some point in the Senate, but I don't see that as one of the most immediate issues Congress is going to deal with.
And what about Enron? Some 250 congressmen got financial support of one kind or another from Enron. What impact on Congress will the shadow of the Enron debacle have, do you think, Juliet?
It's hard to see, you know, particularly because, as you know, there were Democrats as well as Republicans who received contributions from Enron. But, you know, certainly we're going to see hearings in both chambers beginning tomorrow, and this really is something that's going to occupy a lot of time. I think what you certainly can expect is a number of different legislative measures moving through both chambers that will address at least some of the symptoms of the Enron problem and hopefully addressing the root of the problem.
So maybe some things on corporate accountability and oversight, but also on retirement planning and pension funds?
Exactly. Things like that. Or, you know, I was just talking to John LaFalce. He's a Democrat from New York who's the top Democrat on the Financial Services Committee. He was talking about boosting oversight by the SEC as a way of making sure something like this doesn't happen again.
Do you have a sense that Congress feels public outrage pushing them to take substantive moves after Enron's collapse?
Yes, I was home with a lawmaker, Shelley Moore Capito, a Republican freshman from West Virginia, just last week. People were asking about Enron, and so I think she and other lawmakers feel like something needs to be done in the near future on it.
Do you see a broader ideological shift brewing here? We see the new cover on Time magazine. It says, "You're on your own, baby." Every American sort of fending for themselves on health care, on retirement, on so many fronts. Is there a shift that says, hey, we do need a little more government structure in here, or we're all just floating atoms and vulnerable?
Certainly some lawmakers make that argument and a number of voters, but I think there's also a sizable element of, you know, for example, Republican leaders who would say we don't want to go too far in inserting government because the markets kind of work. They didn't collapse with Enron's collapse.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly reignites the debate on that issue.
Finally, what's the mood on Capitol Hill? The Hart office building just finally reopened yesterday after all its anthrax cleansing. What's the mood?
People are actually pretty cheerful. You know, their lawmakers coming and greeting each other, saying Happy New Year. I mean, it's really a fairly relaxed and cheerful atmosphere. They're only here for a couple days, then they leave. They come back just for one night for State of the Union, then they're gone again, with the exception of, for example, some of these lawmakers who are investigating Enron. So I think people also, you know, just don't feel the same pressure that they did at the end of last year when they were trying to reach a budget deal and a deal on economic stimulus.
Juliet Alpern is a reporter with The Washington Post. She spoke to us from Washington. Enron employees are only the most recent casualties. Before that, it was workers at Lucent and Xerox who saw their retirement savings plummet with the declining stock market. Your own company may be part of the trend. Today, Americans plan for retirement with real choices and real risks, but the risk isn't equally shared. Pampered executives can leave a dying company with their golden years still golden. Employees below them may leave with next to nothing. In these uncertain financial times, are you on track to retire? Ever? Is your 401k in order? Is America's new goodbye and good luck retirement philosophy working for you? You can join our conversation tonight by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me now from South Bend, Indiana, is Teresa Ghilarducci, professor of economics at the University of Notre Dame. She's author of Labor's Capital, The Economics and Politics of Private Pensions. Good evening and welcome, Teresa Ghilarducci.
Thank you. Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. So let's jump in here. First, give us the basics. How many Americans are saving for retirement, and how are they doing it?
Good question. Only 71% of Americans say that they're saving for retirement.
Do you believe that number?
Well, no. A nice two-thirds of those, so two-thirds of, you know, 70%, say that they have enough. But the numbers show that they're overconfident by probably a factor of two, meaning probably about 40% of Americans are really ready to retire around the age of 65 and 67. So, no, I don't believe the number that three-fourths of the people think that they're saving and ready for retirement.
How are Americans doing this saving and preparation for retirement today?
Well, you mean of the two-thirds that that even are, you know, and...
Two-thirds of the 71%, so 40%.
Two-thirds of the 71%. And so what about those, you know, 30% or 29% of Americans who...
They're just not.
...admit it, that they're not saving? So let's set those aside, and let's think of the people who think they're good Americans and good planners. The ones that say they're saving, about half of what they're doing is doing it on their own. They're doing it with their own contributions at work, or they're doing it through IRAs, you know, through savings and other kinds of savings vehicles.
And when you say contributions at work, do you mean 401k?
Yeah, 401ks or other kinds of deferred compensation. You know, 20% of folk work for non-for-profit and for government agencies, so we can't forget about them. And
different world.
They have really different different pensions, but everybody has something called a deferred compensation. But what people don't realize is that if you are saving on your own, you really have to save more than 20% of your gross take-home pay. That's your pay after, you know, before the taxes are taken out. So if you get $60,000 a year, if you're going to save on your own for retirement, you have to save $1,200 before taxes to even approximate what you'll need.
You're scaring us now. You're saying you've got to save 20% of your gross, your total income from what age?
From, you know, 25.
Okay.
Forever.
Take me to the salt mine now.
That's right.
And just about everybody else, I guess.
Well, that's the other part. I heard your lead in, and you called, you had a good phrase. You called our retirement income security plans now the goodbye and good luck security plan. There's a flip side to that, and it's this attitude that if you don't save, you have to work. So really, a silver lining from a lot of people's point of view, and these are policymakers, economists, and employers, is that if Americans aren't saving and they aren't saving enough, they'll be ready to work when they're 65 and 66.
Well, the way you describe it, I guess they'd better be ready to work. Now, to give us a picture of how American retirement has changed over time.
Yeah, I sure will. Around the time of Roosevelt and Social Security, if you did reach age 65, you probably were working or you were disabled and trying to ask your family for help. That was about it. So the idea that you could retire, that you could have leisure at the end of your working lives, is really only about 40, 50 years old. But it was a hard-won victory of American workers. They gave up. When they could bargain collectively in unions, they gave up a lot of pay, a lot of wages to put it into their pension plans. And that really spilled over to even the non-union group. So there was a real clear feeling that if we were more productive and if we were a richer nation, then people could expect to have some golden years. So for about the past 20, 25 years, you see lots of people retiring when they're still can enjoy their lives, when they're still healthy, but mainly among men. Women, on the other hand, started entering the labor force around the 1960s and 1970s and kept on entering the labor force even when they were older. So men have retired, and they've retired at earlier ages, and women have just kept on working at different ages.
Now, in the minute we have before the break, what's the shift from pension plans to this independent handling of retirement?
I call it a shift from employer and government and individual responsibility model to the individual responsibility model. And you were right in your lead-in. The philosophy now is that you're on your own when it comes to your health insurance. You're on your own when it comes to pensions. And pretty soon, we're all going to be independent contractors, and we'll be on our own for workers' compensation and Social Security. So there's a real definite shift away from employer-provided pensions towards these individual accounts.
Teresa Ghilarducci, we'll talk more about that, but in a word, is that working?
No, it's not working. And Enron has shown us that it's just as vulnerable as the World Trade Center towers to an event that we haven't expected.
Wow, that's vulnerability indeed. We're talking tonight about America's retirement horizon, about how Americans save and don't save for retirement, about how the risk of saving for retirement is shared equally and sometimes often unequally. What do you think? Are Americans prepared for retirement? Are you? Is the historic shift away from pensions, on balance, a good thing? Is the 401k path working for you? Or do you have any idea if you'll be able to retire securely at any age? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or join us online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the American way of retirement. What do you think? Will you retire as comfortably as your parents did? Does the Enron fiasco mean it's time to change the American way of retirement? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined from Notre Dame University tonight by Teresa Ghilarducci and also right now by David Caruso. He's a certified financial planner. He's co-author of Decoding Wall Street. Welcome and good evening, David Caruso.
Well, thank you very much, Tom, for inviting me.
Good to have you. David Caruso, you talk with people all the time about retirement and their plans for retirement, which right away means you don't talk to the average American because a lot of people aren't even thinking about it. So granted that you're talking to a subsection of a subsection, what do you hear? Are people practicing avoidance? Are they diving in and doing it? Speak to us honestly. Teresa paints a picture of an awful lot of Americans not anywhere near ready. How do you see that playing out in your business?
She even scared me. You know, I look at these things, and there's two ways you can approach a problem, and it is a problem. One, you can say, well, you're never going to have enough, so don't even think about it. Or two, you can say, I'm going to think about it, and I'm going to do something, and I'm going to start building. What happened before the 1980s, when 401ks came in, You didn't have to think about it. You didn't have to do anything. You worked for a company for 30 years, and then guess what? You got your tickets, you got your watch. The company liked it because you only lived 7 years probably after that, and they could afford to do that.
Okay, so David Caruso, the 401ks created a whole business that gave you a career. But do you think it's really better for America overall?
Teresa is absolutely 100% right. We have gone from a company and a country that basically took care of the worker that said, good luck with that. Mm-hmm. Now, the good news about the good luck with that is that it made companies like Fidelity and AIM and Putnam, It made them household names because people finally had to take control of their money. They didn't have a lot. They had to work with mutual funds. And it basically stirred an incredible amount of interest in funds that probably wouldn't have been there if people didn't have their assets in those 401k accounts.
So that helped create this great bull run on Wall Street.
Yep.
And for some people, I'm sure it made tremendous nest eggs to retire on. Do you see it as working overall?
Well, let's put it this way. It really is almost an entrepreneurial flair. I'll take control of my life, or someone will have to do it with a pension account. Most of the actuarial assumptions on a pension account about how long they live and I'll take care of them, they're probably based on trying to get rates of return of 5 or 6 or 7%.
Mm-hmm.
And those are good actuarial assumptions, and the people who are painting 8 and 10% assumptions because they didn't want to fund those retirement accounts, they're the ones that are getting into trouble. My feeling is that over long periods of time, and I'm doing back to 1929, mm-hmm. not to say that everyone should have all their money in stocks, but if you did, you would have had a rate of return of about 12%. That's probably twice what actuarial assumptions are, and I'm sure everyone wished that they had Social Security and all the money they put into Social Security, they put into the stock market for all those years.
If only we could all invest into a bull market. But let me ask you something. How honest are you with the people you sit down with? Do they freak out? You know, they're 40-something, and you sit down with them, and do you explain to them that you've come to here, and hey, you're working forever, friend?
I have to. I think I'm more of a motivator and a wake-up call than I am to try and invest in the money, because money, you'll get 10, 12, 13% rates of return over long periods of time if you're efficient. If you do things like the crazy things with Enron and put all your money in a company stock, I agree. That's crazy stuff. That's people not taking control of their life. That's letting their life take control of them. So the reality is, yes, I have to give them a wake-up call. I have to say for every 2 years that you're working, you have to save enough for 1 year of retirement. But guess what? What are the alternatives? To work forever or to not have enough money for retirement? Take control of your life.
Okay, granted this is your business, but what do you think? Do you think that perhaps we need to rein this in a little bit to give some more secure rudder to American retirement? Are we at risk of becoming, you know, a nation of angry anarchist elders who are really, really upset because they're lashed to that wheel forever?
The answer is, you know, I donate 10% of my proceeds to financial literacy of the book. The reality is we have to educate people. The same way they're being retrained for their jobs, they have to be retrained for their pension accounts. And I think that's the only way we can take control of it and bring people into the forefront. So by going forward, yeah, I think that you have to look at some of these issues and you have to train people, and it is a better alternative. And if people can't do that, I say watch out, because every time there's been a horrendous problem with the markets, mm-hmm. the markets have corrected themselves rather quickly. It's when the politicians get in after the fact and they try and change all of these things that causes more problems. I see something happening now which I think could be a bigger problem than it started.
That
if
is,
you're not allowing companies to contribute their stock to a plan, they may not contribute anything. Is that going to be better?
Whoa. David Caruso, the picture doesn't look exactly rosier, but we take heart from your message that it's never too late, I guess. Thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me on.
David Caruso is a certified financial planner and co-author of Decoding Wall Street. Teresa Ghilarducci, we hear you in the background chomping at the bit there.
Oh, sorry. Oh, I was like Al Gore.
No, we're glad to have you.
I was on mute. I'm so sorry. I know who David Caruso is talking to. He's talking to the third of Americans who are surveyed who call themselves planners, that they know they have to save, that they know they want to work, and they're the ones that keep their credit card debt in check, and they're the ones that seek out people like David Caruso.
Mm-hmm.
And there's probably another 20% who know that they could do better. But David paints the picture as if somehow it's under everybody's control about whether or not they have enough, and therefore it's everybody's fault if they don't have enough,
mm-hmm.
meaning that people who don't have enough, it's their fault. The picture is actually much more complicated.
In what dimension?
Well, first of all, we have a retirement system that's really comes from three areas. We're not like Spain or Italy, where it just comes from the government.
Okay.
It was always foreseen that that a third would come from Social Security,
mm-hmm.
from middle-class people,
mm-hmm.
more if you were lower income and much less if you were David Caruso's clients,
mm-hmm.
if you were higher income,
mm-hmm.
that a third would come from your employer. And if you were lucky and if you were in a union and you were in manufacturing, you got that kind of plan that David Caruso says that everybody has. Well,
mm-hmm.
it was only a small portion of folk who could work for 30 years for one company and retire with something that would supplement Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
And a third, for middle-class and upper-class workers, would have to come from your individual savings if you were going to maintain your living standards into retirement.
So that's the traditional formula. Where
right.
does that stand today?
And that happened, and that was there before Putnam and before Fidelity.
Mm-hmm.
Where it stood was that people were pretty good about doing all three. We voted to have Social Security, you know, improve.
Mm-hmm.
We voted to put money away, you know, with our employer, indirectly, you know, by not collecting it in wages. And we were pretty good about not going into debt and pretty good about building up our home equity. And that's really where the individual savings for most Americans comes from. It comes from their home equity.
Mm-hmm.
So on one hand, the picture of about why we're not ready to retire is because that a lot of Americans are in debt. And that is their own fault. It's also the amazing deregulation of credit institutions, that even the Federal Reserve is chomping at the bit, as they would have when David Caruso was talking. I think I was just the proxy for the Federal Reserve.
How many people, though, get company pensions today and compared
yeah.
to 20 years ago?
I'm the right person to ask because I look at these numbers almost every month. There's only about 50% of all workers who have anything from their employer, and that number has stayed about steady for about 30 years. So there hasn't really been a big change in how many folk get it from work.
Now, that's interesting. So that means 401k is in addition to what was already there. It's not
in addition. It's a substitute for it.
Oh, okay. That
401ks have not expanded who gets pensions from work, and that's really another myth. What it does is just really change the way pensions are delivered at work. And 401k plans.
So you're including company contributions
exactly.
to 401k yeah. plans as pension contributions.
Exactly. Right. Right. And that's because employers call them pensions.
But pensions, in the traditional
not.
Understanding, are something that was going to be there when you retired.
Right.
401k may or may not.
You're right. No, you're absolutely right. So I'm using the broad, generous definition.
Mm-hmm.
Only about 25 to 30% of everybody in the private sector gets it from traditional pensions. 80% of people who work for the government, you know, or, you know, state, local
mm-hmm.
government, or places like mine, you know, this sort of
university setting.
University,
mm-hmm.
right, most of us get it from a traditional pension, and on top of that, a kind of icing, you know, of a 401k type plan.
Mm-hmm. So the government bureaucrat job may actually have a real sweet ending on it compared to a lot of private enterprise these days.
Oh, well, it is, because a lot of it is in boring pensions. A lot of the, they don't get stock options, they don't get, you know, CEO kind of pay.
Less up, less down.
Right, but it's kind of boring pensions. You mm-hmm. know, but a lot of high performance private sector firms still have traditional pension plans. Mm-hmm.
Teresa Ghilarducci, stand by. A lot of callers want to join us. John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Hello.
Good evening.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
That's great. I'm trying to write as fast as I can. You're covering a lot of very serious issues here. Let's see. I've written them down, and I think
give us the top of your mind, John.
Okay. Each of our own individual responsibilities to take care of ourselves is what you're saying right now.
That's a reigning philosophy.
Okay. Yeah. Well, 3 months ago, the government was saying, "United we stand," once New York got bombed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of a sudden, it's just cheap talk and a perfect example of how you can exploit words and just walk away and leave someone dead in the water.
But, John, what we're hearing tonight, we've been on our own in retirement terms for 10 years, maybe more.
Yeah.
But when you have a situation like Enron where they can, you know, just leave these people as they are and just they'll have nothing to fall back on, it's not right. I see no reason that the government right now, you know, within 8 hours, can't put a some type of law in place that all these assets are frozen.
But you can't come in and guarantee a stock price. That just doesn't work in the American system.
It has nothing to do with stock price.
Well, if you've got a 401k that's invested in the stock market, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If it's invested in the stock market, it still has to be protected in some way. Those people down in Washington are professionals, and they should be able to figure out a way to work with the system to protect the people of this country.
John, thanks for your call. Teresa Ghilarducci,
yeah.
What about it? You hear in John's call, and now I was really struck. We saw a cover of Time magazine saying, "You're on your own, baby," and the thrust of the article inside, and Time is often a barometer for the sort of middle of the country, is saying, you know what? All this personal responsibility is going too far. We can't handle it anymore. How does that play out on the retirement front?
Yep. No, I think in a couple of ways, and I actually think that attitude has come because the stock market is down, you know, for the past 6-7 months.
In a big way.
And because of Enron. I mean, what looked like it was going to be an inevitable trend towards 401k and individual responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Just like it looked like we were going to have an inevitable trend towards smaller government and budget surpluses is all being reversed because of something like Enron and the decline in the stock market. And what that means for retirement are two things. On the national level, it meant that President Bush's promise and pledge to privatize Social Security,
mm-hmm.
that plan is dead in the water. That is going nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
That's only a plan that looks good when the stock market is in a speculative boom.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that will happen is that employers will have a harder time selling 401k plans to workers
as their whole pension offering.
Yeah, that is going to change, and the employers that have plugged along, like GE, like GM, you know, like even Lucent actually.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about how Lucent is very different than Enron, have plugged along and kept their defined benefit or the traditional plan are now going to be more appreciated by their workers and the public.
Suddenly looks like a great benefit, not a boring old thing.
That's right. It looks secure. It's not sexy, but it's, you know, it's there when you need it.
At least it's there. Teresa Ghilarducci, stand by. We're joined now by Alicia Munell. She's director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. She was a member of the President's Council of Economic Advisors from 1995 to 1997. Good evening and welcome, Alicia Munell.
Oh, good evening. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. Take us to this issue of policy. Do you smell in the wind a change in the reigning ideology, as Teresa Ghilarducci said, that's governed Americans' attitudes toward retirement in the last 10, 20 years? Are we going to see a change as a result of Enron and the new vulnerability feeling people are feeling about retirement?
We've had these 401k plans for now almost 20 years, and it's time to sort of step back and think how they've worked out. In some ways, they were quite appealing. They gave employees a lot of freedom. They could choose whether or not to participate, how much to participate, how to invest their money, and they seemed wonderful when the stock market were going up at 20% a year.
Mm-hmm.
That stopped, as Teresa pointed out. And I think even before Enron, I think the downturn in the market really had subdued enthusiasm about 401k plans.
So what's the alternative? Where might we go from here?
Well, I mean, I think there's several things that can happen. One, that just responding to the immediate Enron situation and doing something to emphasize the importance of diversification. I mean, people just should not have so many eggs in one basket. It doesn't make sense.
That seems horribly obvious now.
At all. And so there's lots of ways you can do that. There's the Barbara Boxer, John Corzine bill that limits holdings to 20%. That's sort of complicated in that, you know, it forces employees to sell stock when their employees' stock is up. People may not like that. There are other things you can do, though. You could sort of say if your employer is going to use stock for the employer match, then you don't offer it as an investment option. You could limit initial contributions. But we're going to have to do something that sends a message of don't buy so much employer stock.
Mm-hmm. You think that may be legislated?
I think that might be legislated, some form of that. And then I think there's definitely going to be some change in how long you have to hold employer stock before you can sell it.
Alicia Munoz, talk to us also, though, about equity issues. Is there a fairness issue in the way that the American retirement system has played out over time?
Fairness in the sense that
well, we read Michael Sandel in New York Sunday Times saying, you know, it's just not fair. The top executives go off, I mean, with maybe $1 million a year in retirement in their 50s, while the people that worked for them go away sometimes with nothing.
No, and the high-income people just have so many ways to diversify. They hold a lot of other assets. They can go to Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley and get some set up so that they can sort of diversify their risks. That's really not possible, or it doesn't happen with the lower-paid people. And for the lower-paid people, their pension is such an important part of their total retirement income. For the high-income people, 401k plans are just minuscule amounts. I mean, the most you can put in is $30,000 a year. That's not very much money for Ken Lay.
In the minute we've got left here, project forward, if we don't have a change in the way Americans plan and act for retirement, what's the picture going to look like in another 15, 20 years when the baby boom generation is deep in the midst of retirement?
Well, people do need to save more than they are saving for retirement, and I think the shift to the 401k plans just puts too much of the risk on the employee, and something's going to have to happen so that the employee doesn't bear that full risk.
And if we don't have a change, what do you foresee down the road?
Well, I mean, I have great confidence in the Social Security system, so that's going to provide a base for retirement income. And I think
we're glad to hear you're confident.
And we are going to have the appropriate changes for 401k plans, just as we had the appropriate changes for the old-fashioned pension plans after the bankruptcy of Studebaker.
Do you see both parties lining up behind that kind of openness to change?
Yes, I think any legislation has to be bipartisan.
And
will be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess everybody took money from Enron, so everybody can.
This is not a partisan issue. This is an issue of equity and concern about older Americans.
Alicia Munoz is director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. Alicia Munoz, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, delighted to be here.
We're talking about America's way of retirement. Is the 401k retirement an illusion for you today? Is your boss facing the same retirement risks that you are? Is it time to rethink the stock market retirement path? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or get into the conversation online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the American way of retirement and the shock to the system that the Enron debacle has really given everyone. Our guest tonight is Teresa Ghilarducci. She's professor of economics at the University of Notre Dame. You're welcome to join the conversation as well. Is the 401k path working for you? Do you have any idea if you'll be able to retire securely? Teresa Ghilarducci, what about the old defined benefit plan that used to be thought of as the pension? Why has it been so attractive for employers over time to move away from that?
It's cheaper, in a word. If employers could say to workers, we do have a retirement plan, it's called 401k, and I contribute to it and you contribute to it, then it's a half lie, because the employer might say, I contribute to it, mm-hmm. but the employer doesn't have to contribute to it in the following year. The employer can decide year from year whether or not they put anything in your pension.
Mm-hmm.
But over time, workers see that they're putting money into it, and they're pleased that the employer forces them, you know, to put some money away.
Sure.
And they have some kind of false confidence in two ways. One, that the employer will keep on putting money into it, and that it will grow at a high rate.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think all over America, and I'm surprised more people aren't calling in, is that when they've had their last quarter report from their 401ks, they actually can see what they've been told is true, that what goes up can also come down. So I think it's going to change the politics and the perception about where retirement responsibility lies.
But could a defined benefit pension work again? I mean, is the 401k thing so deeply factored into business economics in the U.S. now that there's no way to get back to a defined benefit?
These are great questions. Averages show that the 401k is up, and you know, and the defined benefit is down. But the averages are really hiding the fact that there are many core companies that still have the defined benefit plans, and in fact, research shows that they are the kind of high performance companies. Mm. The companies that have defined benefit plans have workforces that are more loyal to them. They have, you know, actually greater skilled workers, a little bit more productivity. Their employment levels are a bit more stable,
mm-hmm.
And therefore, that kind of, like I said, you know, unsexy kind of performance and corporate management is actually going to look a lot better.
Maybe looking good again. Actually, there are a lot of people who want to join this conversation. Let's turn to them. Malcolm is on the line. Welcome, Malcolm. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening, Malcolm.
I'm there. I'm a human resources officer at Harvard University.
All right.
I worked at the university for 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of experience. And what's occurred to me is that 5 to 10 years ago, it was impossible to get young employees to pay attention to the retirement issues.
Mm-hmm.
They'd go, yeah, okay, fine.
Someday.
And today, it's one of the first questions they ask. What is the retirement plan like? What are my financial options? And I think this is terrific. And I generally tell them that the Harvard retirement plan is just one of three components of their retirement income. That is the retirement plan, Social Security, and their savings. And then we talk about the tax-deferred retirement plan option.
Mm. So, Malcolm, let me ask you, Malcolm, are you suggesting then that we shouldn't be nervous Nellies right now? Just hang on, because there's a younger generation of Americans coming along that's going to feel perfectly comfortable being on its own and planning its retirement?
That's what I'm finding. And I think that people in their 40s and 50s who have been always expecting Social Security and
mm-hmm.
the retirement plan to be it, that the generation coming behind them don't expect that.
Well, now there's a vantage point. Malcolm, thank you very much for your call. And Teresa Ghilarducci, what about it? Is this just a generational, a weak knees here and wait for the reinforcements to arrive from the younger generations? They'll be fine with all this.
Malcolm does paint sort of an optimistic picture, but the national numbers really don't show the trend that he's deducing from his Harvard, you know, new employees.
How so?
Well, it looks like, and this has pretty much been stable, that when you are 39 years old, you don't really care that much or have any kind of perception about what your retirement really is about. But when you're 41 and a half,
mm-hmm.
it seems that your attention is more long-term. You can actually think, you know, towards retirement and then start
hits you like a brick.
Putting it out. Right. It really does seem like a real flip point. But it's true that people who might be attracted to Harvard are ones that are self-selected to something that will stable and long-term.
How about people who are attracted to Wendy's or, you know, 7-Eleven?
Yeah, I those are folks in the fastest-growing sectors in our society, service and retail. And these are people whose pay is actually falling, you know, so they really get raises when they either Social Security improves or the minimum wage increases,
mm-hmm.
and they don't tend to be the ones that are asking about retirement at their places of work. I mean, it's fantasy because those places don't provide it.
Let's get another couple of calls, Teresa, if we can, before we run out of time here. Doug is on the line. Welcome, Doug. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to maybe separate the issue between the sort of wage inequity in the United States and sort of the actual 401k plan, because it seems to me that the 401k is still a good thing because it's sort of giving you an incentive for tax-deferred savings, but that the issue of what's going on in the stock market right now and the pain that people are feeling, or even the sort of absolute criminality of Enron, that those are sort of kind of two separate issues.
Well, but what about the insecurity that comes with it, Doug? You know, of course, the market won't guarantee that it's going to be up when you're up for retirement. As a nation, do you feel comfortable with that level of risk and uncertainty?
Well, I mean, I guess I accept it as a reality, and I think that it is something that, you know, you have to manage sort of individually and figure out how you know, you're going to allocate your resources. I mean, I think that the problem of in the United States in terms of, you know, people working at Wendy's and the sort of prospects for their retirement, I think, again, that goes more to sort of the current state of, you know, the wage inequity in the country, and it's not necessarily a problem per se with 401k tax deferred savings. I guess what I'd point out is that at least in my 401k program is one can put into very secure sort of money market type accounts. You don't have to be rolling the dice, and you can shift your allocations, et cetera. And even though I sort of accept the problems that Teresa's been bringing up, I think it's maybe not, you know, to me it doesn't seem inherent in the 401k plan itself.
We take your point. And, Doug, thanks for the call. And we raise the lower income folks because we want to consider the whole sweep here. It's not just people with good access to 401k and the stock market who grow old. Everybody grows old. But, Teresa, what about Doug's central point, which is, look, if you manage your 401k effectively, you're going to be fine.
Well, you know, he got off the line before we could ask him, does he also have a traditional plan at work? Because it turns out that most 401ks are just supplements to a traditional plan. So those are the icing, and those are great. There's an extra way for those planners, you know, to put more money away. So how can they be bad? But what you pointed out is if they are there to substitute for traditional plans, are they there to take support and attention away from Social Security, or attention and support away from the fact you have to be realistic about how much you're putting in, then they're a bad thing. They're also bad in that they do shift, as you implied, the risk of that the stock market going up and down solely on the employee. And also there's something that's really hidden, that the employers are able to shift the administrative cost of a pension plan onto employee much more easily when they provide a 401k.
Mm-hmm.
Employees might like the 401k because they can look up their accounts online. Maybe they even can look at, they can change their allocations very often. But that all costs money, and it's more likely that the employee pays for that, which can have a real significant effect on their after fee return on their 401k.
Well, we're going to be keeping a close eye on what happens nationally as the country digests the meaning of Enron and as more and more people wake up to 401ks and everything else that may not add up to a satisfactory retirement. Teresa Ghilarducci, you've been great. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Teresa Ghilarducci is professor of economics at the University of Notre Dame. She's author of Labor's Capital, The Economics and Politics of Private Pensions. You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Over the weekend, hundreds of people converged on Boulder, Colorado, to attend the city's 15th annual festival devoted to the music of Gustav Mahler. In this radio diary, Gerald Fox, the president of the Gustav Mahler Society of New York, talks about why Mahler's music resonates with audiences in these complex times and about his organization's push to have Mahler's 10th Symphony played to memorialize the victims of September 11th.
The music of all the great masters are contemporary, but the emotions of Haydn and Mozart and Beethoven are not necessarily those that we can feel directly. But Mahler's emotions really grip us, even today. They have ever since he wrote the symphonies. And he had wrote the most emotional symphonies of any who ever composed. Tragic, joyous, you name it. And people have latched on to that. But the music really grips you, happy, sad, you name it, even humorous. He has the widest range of emotions of any composer I can think of. What we react to in these times, since September 11th, that was a great tragedy. So we look for music that reflects the tragic feeling of those days and also the feeling of hope that the music has. Now, the 10th Symphony is unique in the sense that by sheer accident, one of the most emotional parts, the last movement, was inspired by the death of a fireman. Soon after the tower tragedy, when I heard that 346 firemen died in it, I was reminded of the 10th Symphony. Because, I can best express it by reading a letter I wrote to the fire commissioner. Dear commissioner, the staggering thought of 300-plus courageous New York firemen killed in the World Trade Center terrorist attack led me to what I consider a most appropriate memorial for these brave men. Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 10, his final composition, was inspired in part by the death of a New York City fireman who died while battling a fire at 217 Canal Street, and the fireman who perished was Charles W. Kruger, deputy chief of the City of New York Fire Department, commanding the 2nd Division. He had been in the fire service for 36 years and was a beloved leader. Mahler was living at the time at the Hotel Majestic, West 72nd Street and Central Park West. On February 16th, hearing a confused noise, Mahler and his wife Alma leaned out of their 11-story windows and saw a funeral cortege on Central Park West, which had stopped directly below their window. Mahler heard a stroke on a muffled drum, then dead silence. As the cortege moved on, Alma, already in tears, looked at her husband leaning out the window and saw tears streaming down his face. That cortege drum stroke and the solemn atmosphere of the event so impressed him that he used it as the start of the 5th movement of his symphony in progress, the 10th, which he was to work on in 1910. Listening to the 10th Symphony, soon after the tragedy of the World Trade Center, the tragedy of the music augments your feelings, and the spiritual ending is sort of like a ray of hope. It's very difficult to put music into words, but that's basically, I think, the feeling one gets from listening to the symphony. Very tragic, very somber, very funereal. It has the proper feeling of quiet, meditation, tragedy, hope, everything. Music can do that. If we are successful in getting this performed, the feelings of that movement will, I think, reflect exactly what most people feel. The tragedy of the movement in general, but the ending with its intense vindication of courage and hope. It's sort of as if clouds break and you see a ray of hope for the future.
Gerald Fox is the president of the Gustav Mahler Society of New York. He lives in Bethpage, New York. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is W.